دايما الله مولانا دايما الله مولانا دايما الله مولانا دايما الله مولانا انظروا العربي مولاي محمد انظروا المصطفى نبينا نبينا حارس القيامة مولاي محمد الشفاع في الأمة مولاي محمد دايما الله مولانا دايما الله مولانا نبينا 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 صلي ولي عربي العربي العربي صلي ولي نبينا 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 صلي ولي العربي 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 صلي ولي
Master of the oud and classical guitar with Daimala from his 2001 album African Gnawa Blues. He combines African American jazz and blues motifs with the traditional stylings and instrumentation of Arab, African Gnawa, and sub-Saharan musical traditions. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, July the 23rd. And we begin our program today with an unintended consequence of Israel's carnage in Gaza. Our guest says it is actually shifting the public discourse. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and director of its New Internationalism Project. She helped found the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation in 2001 and remains on its advisory board. She writes and speaks widely across the United States and around the world as part of the global peace movement and is an informal advisor to several top UN officials on Middle East and UN democratization issues. And we're delighted to have you, Phyllis, with us today. How are you doing? Phyllis?
Yes.
Oh, how are you doing today?
No, I'm okay. I'm great. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. Thanks for being with me. Well, what do you know of the situation right now as it stands in Gaza?
There has been a great deal more fighting and more casualties today. There are talks apparently still underway in Cairo, but no potential ceasefire proposal that has any chance of working is yet underway. This is a very difficult moment. The UN Human Rights Council in Geneva has decided to form a commission of inquiry into alleged Israeli war crimes in Gaza, and Israel is asking the U.S. for more money, for $250 million more, $225 million to be precise, for new parts for its missile defense system. So it's a day when things remain as grim as they are for everybody in Gaza, and a ceasefire that actually has the potential to work, meaning a ceasefire that isn't just a return to the conditions in Gaza on July 7th, the day before this particular crisis began to erupt, where people had no access to clean water, electricity only 4 or 5 hours a day, the sewage treatment plant not functioning, the hospitals out of medicine. You know, if that's the idea, that there should be a ceasefire and a return to that, I don't think it's going to work.
What do you think is behind the escalation by Israel, the military escalation into Gaza. I mean, on the one hand, people could say, well, it's just a matter of getting the upper hand militarily on an enemy. But is there another, is there something else behind this escalation, this awesome assault?
I think there's a couple of things going on. One is, as you say, this is something that the Israelis have made clear publicly, that they think they need to do and have the right to do periodically what they call mowing the lawn in Gaza, meaning just mowing down people is what it actually means. I don't think that's what they would say it means, but in practice, that's what it has meant. And it's been every 2 or 3 years there's been this kind of a massive escalation of airstrikes against Gaza. The particularities of this one had a lot to do with preventing the unity government that the Palestinians had created after very painstaking negotiations, preventing that from being able to function, making sure that Gaza remained devastated, isolated, and unable to function, making sure that the people of Gaza gained nothing from having the new unity government that included no members of Hamas in it. The Hamas leadership in Gaza had given up their role in the administration of Gaza, turning that over to this new unity government, which didn't include any members of Hamas. But despite that fact, the Israelis were very committed to making sure that it did not work. So that meant money was withheld so that the budget in Gaza was unable to pay the hundreds of thousands of municipal workers who together make up the vast majority of the workforce in Gaza, supporting huge extended families, making sure that there was no improvement in the lives of ordinary people in Gaza. And in this, they were joined by the new government in Egypt, very different than the last escalation, which was in November of 2012, when Gaza had a government in Cairo that was supportive of the people of Gaza and, in fact, supportive of the Hamas government, which meant keeping the Gaza-Egypt border crossing open. It meant that the Egyptians orchestrated an arrangement under which a number of foreign ministers from other Arab countries and, indeed, the foreign minister of Turkey as well visited Gaza City under the Israeli bombs. It was very evident to the world that Gaza was not isolated. Right now, it's the opposite. Right now, there has been, of course, the military coup in Egypt that overthrew the government that had been sympathetic to the people of Gaza. And the government in place now, a military government led by General El-Sisi, backed by the United States, negotiated an original ceasefire with Israel alone and announced it without ever consulting the Palestinian leadership, without ever consulting Hamas, and said, this is it, take it or leave it, when it would have led to exactly the arrangement that I said would never work. It would have led to a return to the status quo before this particular escalation, something that was known to be completely unacceptable to people in Gaza. So the question of why now had a lot to do with the position of Israel in wanting to undermine the unity government. And then they were given essentially a new excuse for the escalation with the kidnap and killing of the three young Israelis. When that happened, despite the fact that what came out later was that Israeli military and police officials knew within just a few hours that the three young men were almost certainly already dead, they decided not to make that public, but instead to keep the hopes alive for the families, a very cynical move, and to spend those almost 3 weeks in massive raids against Hamas in the West Bank, in which somewhere between 500 and 800 Palestinians were arrested, including 28 members of the Palestinian parliament, and including about 50 former prisoners who had been released 2 years ago in the massive prisoner exchange. And in that situation, that's one of the big demands now from the Palestinians, that those prisoners who had been released in the prisoner exchange for Gilad Shalit and have now been picked up again and held in Israeli prisons without being charged with anything. None of them were blamed for the kidnapping and killing of the three young men. That was simply a pretext. But it led to a massive escalation. 8 Palestinians in the West Bank were killed. There were airstrikes against Gaza during that period before this the official day in which we acknowledge that this escalation happened. So this was really a major move by Israel, even before the back-and-forth rocket issue emerged from Gaza.
Some people see behind the escalation Israel basically using this method to kind of goad Iran into defending Hamas and therefore actually accomplish what it has been seeking for a long time, which is direct conflict with Iran. Does this have any water? Does this hold any water to you, this theory?
Not to me. I don't think that's accurate. That's not to say that I don't think there's any connection. I think that, among other things, one of the reasons for the U.S. Refusal to say anything publicly that even hints at a criticism of Israel, despite the obvious views in parts of the Obama administration, including from Secretary of State Kerry, who famously said on an open mic, yeah, this is some pinpoint strike, very sarcastically, you know, indicating very clearly that he didn't buy the Israeli line. But in public, he has not wavered from the official line that Israel has the right to defend itself, as if this was all about self-defense. And I think part of the reason for that is that there is an unwillingness to say anything critical of Israel while the Iran talks are underway. Because if there was anything critical said, it would set off even more virulent attacks from the pro-Israel supporters in Congress, in the Israel lobbies in the U.S., in some of the press, etc. And I think the administration in Washington really does not want to see that linkage being made. So I think there is a link with Iran, but I don't think it has much to do with the question of Iran supporting Hamas. The relationship between Iran and Hamas still exists, but it's not the robust relationship that it was a few years ago. It's a much more diminished relationship now, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
What about the perception of President Obama himself in the region? His hawkishness has come through in an alarming way on this question, just simply saying, well, Israel has a right to defend itself. And I agree with you that that is not the issue, is it? But it still suffices as the rationale for the United States to support what it would have considered unsupportable not too long ago, and by this particular president.
Yeah, it's been supportable in the U.S. for a very long time, and I think people in the region don't see this as much of a change. I think people there are much less surprised or disappointed at this stage in President Obama. I think there was a great deal of hope early on in the president's first term. This was somebody who, on his second day in office, appointed a new envoy to the Middle East peace talks that was known for his independent thinking, that was not dependent on accountability to pro-Israel organizations in Washington or in Congress. I'm referring, of course, to former Senator George Mitchell. But then it became clear that Senator Mitchell had no freedom of action. He was constrained by the administration. The speech in Cairo that outlined an entirely new approach of the United States to people and struggles underway in the region during the Arab Spring and before, I think there was a great deal of hope around that. But again, it became clear quite quickly that that rhetoric is not matched by policy, that this is a president and an administration that absolutely talks the talk of equality, justice, human rights, but doesn't walk the walk of those things.
You rewrote in the Nation magazine, published your article on the 15th, and I read it, but you said something quite stunning, actually, that an unintended consequence of what's going on, the carnage that's going on in Gaza, is that there has been a discernible shift in public attitudes around this whole question of Israel and Palestine. Could you talk a bit about how you discern that shift? What is it like? What is happening?
Well, I think that there's a number of factors underway, and this is not something that exploded suddenly with this current escalation. This is something that I would say has been underway for a decade or more, that there has been a massive shift in discourse, in public discourse, in the press more slowly, among public awareness more quickly, across the United States. The disconnect between what people say and believe in the Washington bubble, members of Congress who think that they have the American people with them when they vote in the Senate, for instance, 100-0 for an outrageous cheerleading resolution for Israeli military attacks without a word of concern about Palestinian victims of those attacks. It turns out that that's not the case. There's a new poll that just came out indicating that Democrats, and this is particularly important for the Obama administration, Democrats are divided almost exactly evenly between those who say their opinion of Israel is favorable versus unfavorable. 49 said favorable, 48% unfavorable. That's overall opinion of Israel. On the question of is Israel justified or not in taking military action, 45% of Democrats said it's justified, 42% unjustified, again, within the margin of error. On the question of is the amount of military force Israel is using in Gaza, is that too much, too little, or about right, 51% of Democrats said it's too much. So this is a huge shift, that we're seeing. We're seeing it in the press coverage. Today's New York Times, a huge central op-ed by my great friend and very brave Gazan journalist, Mohammed Omer, Darkness Falls on Gaza. We're seeing Palestinian voices consistently in the mainstream press. They're not doing it well. They're not doing it right. I don't want to pretend that everything is great. The recent struggles at NBC, for instance, where a regular commentator on MSNBC had her contract ended suddenly yesterday because she was very critical of the overall mainstream media's approach to this whole contract, to this whole conflict. And in return, she lost her job. That's not, I'm not trying to say it's all good, but the shift from what it once was, where we never saw a Palestinian voice in the mainstream press, we never heard Palestinians on U.S. television, for instance, that simply isn't the case anymore. Now, part of that is because of the rise of social media. In Gaza, whatever Israel might try to do to keep out the international press, although they haven't done that as much this time, they have in the past, it doesn't work when everybody in Gaza has a cell phone, and in the brief hours that the electricity comes on for a moment, that's what people do, is they rush to charge their cell phone so they can send their photographs, their videos out into the world. So people have alternative sources of information, which a decade ago were simply not available, and that's been huge. The role of Al Jazeera and other Arabic and English language satellite channels from around the world have an entirely different approach to covering the conflict than the U.S. media, and that means that people in the U.S. have options to learn far more. The work of organizations like the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, Jewish Voice for Peace, a host of others that have been working specifically on this question of changing the U.S. discourse, influencing that discourse, is huge. You know, it's not great. We'll see what happens in the next few days. The House will be voting on a very similar resolution to the one the Senate passed so shamefully, Resolution 107. And as of yesterday, it only had 16 co-sponsors, but now those numbers are going up. We can expect it to go quite high. And that's what, you know, we now have people that are willing to make the phone call their member of Congress and say, please don't support this bill. It doesn't reflect what the American people want. It doesn't reflect international law. You shouldn't do it. In the past, members of Congress never heard from anybody with that opinion.
You know, it was interesting in the article you noted that this shift in discourse was especially noteworthy within the Jewish community. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been, I would say, the most dramatic there, where you see, and again, this has been underway for a decade or more. I think part of the reason that lobby organizations like AIPAC and others have been as lashing out, if you will, as much as they have, is that they are very, very nervous that they're losing support in the Jewish community, particularly among young Jews, who don't have the same allegiance to Israel that Jews, say, of my generation grew up with. You know, when I was growing up, that was the totality of our identity. It wasn't really about God. It was about Israel. That isn't the case anymore. And you now have a situation, certainly AIPAC still has the money. They still have tons of money. They represent the right wing in the Jewish community. And as is true everywhere else, the right wing tends to have the money. So the money follows AIPAC. They have a huge amount of money. But they no longer can claim that they represent the Jewish community and that they will provide Jewish votes when they meet with members of Congress. Instead, you have an organization like J Street in the center. J Street played a very key role in breaking the taboo that said only AIPAC can speak for Jews in the United States. That simply isn't the case anymore. J Street is a somewhat centrist organization. And then on the left, you have Jewish Voice for Peace, which is increasingly powerful and big. It has over 150,000 supporters and chapters in 40 or so cities around the country, student chapters all over on college campuses. So the Jewish community is now far more diverse in its opinions about Israel than it was before.
And how is this expressed within Israel, this shift?
I think there's a lot of unease. The political opinion within Israeli society has moved dramatically to the right in recent years. And unfortunately, that's the most true among young Israelis. That's where you see it the most strongly. These young men who have confessed to the horrific, horrific torture killing of Mohammed Abu Khadr, the young Palestinian who was kidnapped and burned to death supposedly in retaliation for the kidnapping of the three young Israelis who were kidnapped and killed, reflect that. You know, there are members of the Knesset who have made speeches in recent days that are really overt, direct calls to genocide. One of them quoted a speech from some years ago and rewrote it in the parliamentary record and referenced it as a speech, where she said that we must kill even the Palestinian women because otherwise they will give birth to what she called little snakes. That was her term for Palestinian babies. And it was so reminiscent of the kind of language that you heard in this country in the genocidal wars against native people here, when Indian killing generals would talk about, one of them in particular made a comment where he said, "Nits make lice. Yes, kill the babies too. They will grow up to be Indians." In this case, the babies are little snakes. You have to kill them and kill their mothers because otherwise they will grow up to be bigger snakes. So the kind of racism that's become normalized in Israeli discourse really stands quite in opposition to the shift that's underway in U.S. public opinion, to some degree. I mean, I don't want to overstate what the shift is in the U.S. It's still very problematic, but it has changed dramatically.
What does this say about, is there a sense that this situation as it is unfolding and people are witnessing, I mean, in real time, the carnage, does it give rise to an internal conversation about the similarity in conduct of and the mindset of the government with the mindset that they had fled in 1940s?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge contradiction here, and it's becoming very uncomfortable for the government and others. It was interesting, after the killing of young Mohammed Abu Khadr, there was a run by people in official circles, in the media and elsewhere, to distance themselves from that particular killing. Not from anything that the IDF, the Israeli military, was doing in Gaza, not the slaughter of children by by airstrikes. That is carried out by what Israeli officials continue to say is the most moral army in the world, over and over again. The slang version is, we hit and we cry. You know, supposedly Israeli soldiers are so upset by what they're forced to do that they cry about it, which, frankly, whether it's true or not, is so profoundly irrelevant to the commission of war crimes that that it's almost an insult to the many deaths. But in this particular case, because it was so personalized and horrific, it was, you know, this young man tortured to death, you had people saying, this isn't who we are. This isn't what Israelis do. This isn't what Jews do. And of course, it turns out this is precisely what Israelis do. This is precisely what Jews do. It's exactly what President Obama tried to say when he talked about his opposition to torture and particularly at Guantanamo, where he said, this isn't what we do. But unfortunately, it's precisely what we do. He was referring to what we were doing at that moment. So it's this notion of an effort to say, we somehow, the big collective us, whether it's in the United States or in Israel, we're different than that. But the problem is, we're not different. We are responding to this kind of racist propaganda in the face of Israel. In the case of Israel, in the U.S., these are longstanding policies of determining what's known as U.S. national interests, defined on the basis of what's in the interests of the Pentagon and major corporations. So the notion of what, quote, we do has really very little to do with the choices of individual Americans or individual Israelis.
The proposal by Egypt has fallen apart. So what's next, do you think?
Well, I'm afraid that it's going to be more of the same. The indications we've gotten in hints from Secretary Kerry's statements in Cairo, we haven't heard anything today from his meetings in Ramallah or Jerusalem. Of course, he won't go to Gaza, which is where he should go for real negotiations, but that doesn't seem to be in the cards. And it might give the people of Gaza a little bit of a break if he was there. The Israelis might stop shelling for a few minutes. But aside from that, it seems that he's saying that we need a ceasefire first, and then we can tell the Gazans that we can discuss everything they need to discuss. The problem is that's exactly what happened at the end of the last escalation in November of 2012, when the ceasefire agreement included a specific commitment to open the border crossings. It was Article 1C of that of the text of that ceasefire agreement, and the implementation of that was supposed to begin 24 hours after the ceasefire took effect. Of course, it never happened. There never were those discussions. There was no opening of the border crossings. Gaza remained a large prison. So I think there's a great deal of fear that if they agree to that, the same thing will happen again. Because without U.S. pressure, there will be no reason for Israel to take seriously any commitment that it might make in a ceasefire agreement. And 6 months or a year or 2 years, we'll see another Israeli onslaught.
Phyllis Benes, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., who has been our guest. Thank you so much, Phyllis, for being with us today. Extraordinarily insightful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. We'll be back to Detroit right after this. Well, Kevin Orr, the state-appointed emergency manager for the city of Detroit, on Monday got a huge boost to his bankruptcy reorganization plan. And that boost was that the workers and retirees who were supposed to vote on whether to accept a cut in their pensions and other benefits actually overwhelmingly voted yes. Our correspondent on Detroit, Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, joins us now to bring us up to speed on what has been going on and what will be happening as the city now supposedly is in a better position to make the case that it should officially qualify for bankruptcy protection against creditors and proceed with its draconian recovery plan. Abayomi, good to have you with us today.
Good to be back.
Thanks. Now, tell us about this vote. It was overwhelming, and it, you know, although you had said that there were pockets of resistance, apparently in the end, overwhelmingly, the retirees voted okay to cut 4.5% off of their monthly checks?
Well, we don't know that to be the case at all. This whole entire process has been shrouded in secrecy and manipulation. There was no independent monitoring. The votes were tabulated by a firm in California. So we really don't know what the actual breakdown was in the vote. It was reported today that I believe around half or less than half of those who were sent ballots actually returned ballots. This is what was put out in the corporate press. And even on July the 10th, which was the day before the actual deadline, it was a report that indicated that only 40% of the retirees and workers had sent their ballots back in. So we really don't know if this is true, if it's accurate. There's no way of us having access to the ballots, to the count. So we're really not surprised. They've been announcing ever since the voting process started that they were going to win. On the day of the deadlines for the ballots to get in, they had already announced that the plan put forward by Jones Day had won. So we really have no way of really knowing how accurate this vote is and how accurate the statements are.
That's a great point, and it's in direct contrast to what is being reported. What's being reported is an approval by 82% of police and fire retirees and 73% of general pensioners who basically have accommodated what is known as the great bargain, that if they made the sacrifice, it would give the city that much more in terms of reserves to impress the court that it has come up with a very good formula for getting out of bankruptcy by Kevin Orr had predicted that by October, Detroit ought to be once again solvent.
Well, this is what they're saying, and what they're saying bears little resemblance to reality in the city of Detroit. Last week, there was a objections hearing on Tuesday, in which over 80 people filed legal objections, spoke openly in the bankruptcy court. The hearings lasted all day. The issue of the massive water shutoffs were brought into the bankruptcy for the first time, prompting the judge to call for Jones Day, which is actually administering the affairs of the city, to bring in the deputy director of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. He was forced to come into court.
We just need to indicate that Jones Day is the law firm from which Kevin Orr comes.
He's a former partner.
It already serves as a kind of conflict of interest issue here, that the law firm is actually in charge of running the day-to-day affairs of the city.
And they're doing it very poorly. Detroit has gotten worldwide news attention for a number of reasons, the most recent of which has been the massive water shutoffs that even the United Nations agencies that deal with water resources and access to potable water says the policy being enacted by the emergency manager is inhumane. And the judge even said last Tuesday, July 15th, during the objections hearings, that the water shutoffs were bad publicity for the emergency management of the city, and it was bad for the bankruptcy. And what happened on Monday, we were again in bankruptcy court. The deputy director, Daryl Latimer, had to show up again at the request of Judge Stephen Rhodes to report on what the Detroit Water and Sewage Department was doing under the aegis of the emergency manager. And he openly declared a 15-day moratorium on shutoffs and said that they were going to take a more aggressive approach to letting people know about purported assistance that exists for people to pay their water bills. But, yes, the whole process is highly questionable. Anytime you have a situation where it's reported today in the Los Angeles Times or yesterday in the Los Angeles Times, that out of the 32,300 ballots that were sent out, supposedly they said were sent out from this firm in California, only 15,629 were returned. So we're talking about less than 50% of people even bothered to return the ballot. This is according to their figures. They are claiming that 73% of those in two particular classes, one of workers and pension holders, another one of retirees who are also pension recipients, 73% voted in favor. And they're claiming that 27% voted in opposition. But we really have no way of determining the legitimacy of this vote. Also, one aspect of the voting which they were not able to distort was the role of the second-tier capitalist creditors, Syncor Guarantee Corporation and Financial Guarantee Corporation. Since they were second-tier creditors, bond insurers, they voted no. They voted to reject the plan. So it remains to be seen whether the plan is actually going to be approved. The judge, many people feel, would attempt to cram down by forcing Syncor and Financial Guarantee, and there are others as well, to accept as little as 10 cents on a dollar for what they claim is owed to them by the city of Detroit. Syncor, of course, was set up to ensure the interest rate swaps surrounding the casino revenues from Bank of America and UBS, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and UBS. Therefore, we don't really know until this is going to be litigated, ostensibly on August the 14th. The hearings could last a month. And, of course, we're going to continue to oppose this entire process. It's not being carried out in the benefit of the majority of the people here in the city of Detroit. The conditions, the city services are worsening. Crime is escalating. If you look at the situation involving the public transportation that is available here in the city, there are massive cutbacks that are still going on. But Kevin Orr, who works for Rick Snyder, who is a multimillionaire, a Republican conservative venture capitalist, who works in cooperation with the banks and the other multinational corporations dominate the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan.
That's the governor, by the way.
Yes. They're doing a terrible job of managing this whole process, and they've been exposed throughout the world. Just last Friday, thousands of people came into the streets to protest against the water shutoffs, against privatization, against emergency management and pension cuts. The demonstration that was organized in less than 2 weeks' time, it was held in conjunction with the National Netroots Conference, held 3 days last week at Cobo Conference Center downtown. The National Nurses United, which is the largest organization of healthcare nurses in the United States, they have some 188,000 members, issued a public health emergency for the city of Detroit based upon the massive water shutoffs to some 15,000 households throughout the city. So, despite the propaganda, which bears very little resemblance to reality, if you look at the Sunday Free Press just 3 days ago, the front page consisted of almost macabre utopian illustration of Illich Holdings' plan to build a new hockey arena, a new entertainment district between downtown and Midtown. And this is being done for $600 plus million. This is what they've said officially. But at the same time, we have people in the city of Detroit who, in the thousands of having their water shut off, who can't find meaningful employment, senior citizens. Yes, go ahead.
No, I'm saying we will. This was a good update. In fact, what you were able to establish is that although it has been reported as an overwhelming support for the city manager's plan, an overwhelming vote that would allow him to proceed with his draconian restructuring plan, there's another side to it. You have established that, and we of course will be taking stock as this develops, because there's going to be a another court date soon in August, and we will be able to tell whether in fact the judge allows the trial to go ahead or whether the objections will impede that plan. So thanks so much for bringing this to our attention today and allowing us to understand that there is a whole other side to this story just the same. Thanks a lot, Abiyomi, for being with us today.
All right.
For your report. We'll be back right after this, and we'll talk about chokeholds. A funeral will be held this evening in New York City for Eric Garner, a 46-year-old father of six who died last Thursday after a violent arrest by police for allegedly selling what is known as Lucy, or single cigarettes that were untaxed. Two police officers involved in Garner's fatal arrest, including the officer who held Garner in an illegal chokehold, have yet to be fully questioned about the incident. But I want to tell you that there's a reason, and it is something that needs to be paid attention to. I've covered many, many cases in New York City involving the dispatching of human beings, almost all of them African American and Latino, and almost in all instances, the police officers were white, via chokehold and other means, awful means of asphyxiating people and, you know, just taking their lives. Under what are called departmental rules and by union contract, a police officer who is implicated in some kind of a crime that might be the result, that might result in prosecution or in any disciplinary action, under union, under the union contract, does not have to talk to anybody for 48 hours or two working days, whichever suits, whichever is to the advantage of the officer. Now, this is union contract being invoked here. But on the one hand, you can say, well, that's a union issue, and that's a union benefit, as it were, for when you are a police officer and you're part of the Patrolman's Benevolent Association, which is the union. But what this really means, and this is an issue that has to be tackled, what this really means is that police officers, in situations where they need to be questioned in a matter that has to do with taking a life or any other criminal matter, this union protection is actually protection or temporary immunity from prosecution. That's how it should be seen. The average citizen doesn't get to tell a district attorney, well, you know, there's this question of me being linked to a murder, but I will be unavailable to talk to you until Tuesday or Thursday or whatever it is. It suits me according to my 48-hour rule. Citizens don't have that privilege, don't have that advantage of protecting themselves from prosecution. But under this union provision, police officers legally can say to the DA, get lost. I don't have to talk to you for 48 hours or 2 working days. Now let's take a look at that. If a crime, say, occurs on a weekend, or let's say close to a weekend, let's say a Thursday, as this crime occurred on the 17th, which was July Thursday, July the 17th, and for the police officers involved who should have been the target of questioning, immediate questioning and possible prosecution, 2 working days might put them to, say, Monday or Tuesday, depending on their schedule. And for those days that they are unavailable via the terms of the union contract, they technically are enjoying temporary immunity from prosecution. And certainly, they are enjoying the privilege of not being questioned, not having to account for themselves and their actions in the matter at hand. This 48-hour rule is at the root of a whole lot of really bad things happening in cases, especially controversial cases. Because while this temporary immunity kicks in, it has been my experience in covering many of these cases that that's where the stories are aligned. People have a time to talk to each other, to get their facts straight according to their defense. They're able to do a whole bunch of things, rearrange a whole bunch of facts, come up with entirely different scenarios that didn't exist. And by the time they're questioned, a whole different picture emerges as to their culpability in the crime being investigated. So I'm suggesting that it is time to take a look at this 48-hour rule. Now, the mayor of the city of New York, Bill de Blasio, has, of course, responded very nicely to this. He says, well, you know, we have to have a vigorous investigation. The police chief has said, yes, we will not only investigate right away, but we will also retrain all of our officers in the proper detention of citizens and not to use chokeholds, which, by the way, has been outlawed since 1993 within the police department. And one assumes that any officer coming into the department, going through the training for police officers, that this is routinely stressed, that chokeholds are illegal. But this 48-hour rule is a blanket and has been, to me, this is the critical matter here. The use of the 48-hour rule. We saw that because this incident was captured by bystanders and eyewitnesses on their cell phones, so there is no denying what happened. They literally caught the death of this man as it was occurring. And they caught the police officers, the various police officers, and their roles in this incident. So there is no denying that. Now, what is interesting is that the minute this thing became known and the 48-hour rule kicks in, the chief players are removed from questioning. And it is legal for them to do so. They are invoking what they say are their union rights. So the question is, when does the criminal process, the judicial process, trump union rights? Why is it that a police officer gets this protection automatically that no citizen would enjoy? You can't tell some. You can't tell a detective or a district attorney, assistant DA, coming to investigate you about any kind of crime that you don't feel like talking to them today. Maybe next Wednesday at 6 o'clock. You don't get to do that as a citizen. But in every single instance where we have seen these atrocities occur, the people who should be the target of prosecution and investigation, they are the ones who invoke automatically the 48-hour rule and they hide behind it. And that kicks in a whole series of things that in many cases have derailed justice. And a lot of police officers have walked away from crimes for which they should have been prosecuted and sentenced to very serious terms because they used that 48-hour rule to their advantage and they took that time to concoct the stories that had nothing to do with the facts of the case, to make up all kinds of crazy theories and ideas to vindicate themselves. So I believe it is time that this 48-hour rule be looked at as an impediment to justice. It is a union provision, but that has nothing to do with legal issues, has nothing to do with the prosecution of a crime. And the city has to be asked whether, because a person is a police officer, that person is entitled to a different kind of treatment when that person is said to be connected to a very serious crime. That's the issue. Now, they can talk about all this vigorous investigation all they want. But everybody, from the DA down to the police officers, down to the citizens themselves, they all are accepting the imposition of the 48-hour rule. And that is a huge barrier. Now, I understand that for many police officers, they do suffer sometimes very traumatic effects in situations where horrible things happen and they are implicated, but not in an intentionally criminal way, and it affects them. So in a sense, their reaction to the very crime that they may very well be prosecuted for at the time may leave them at a disadvantage if they were to be questioned right then and there. I get all of that. But at the same time, we have this question. Why does a police officer, simply because he's a police officer, why does he enjoy or she enjoy this privilege that no citizen ever would have to invoke temporary immunity from prosecution, which is really what it is, under the guise of a union benefit? That has to be revisited. And that has to be dealt with as a major issue. We'll be looking at this case in greater detail next week. And we will be deconstructing it because it has happened so often in New York. And I'm just so upset about the parade. I mean, the long list of names that after a while you say, when does it stop? And why is it that we see the same patterns occurring over and over again? But just keep that in mind. The 48-hour rule will be part of our discussion. And that is something that I think is at the root of a lot of shenanigans going on in investigations. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope this program was of value to you. You let me know, of course, I hope, by writing me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Keep it right here. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks so much. Hey, yeah.